This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as Congress debates military action in Syria, some lawmakers and legal experts raise concern about further intervention in the region. Massive floods in South Sudan displace thousands of residents as aid groups struggle to reach those affected. And we go to Pakistan's Swat Valley, where a group of women have formed a jirga challenging a powerful tradition long dominated by men. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Thousands of Romanians continue to protest a proposed Canadian-owned open-pit gold mine in the Roșia-Montana region of the country. It would be the largest mine of its type in Europe. The government is expected to vote in the coming months on a new law that would speed up the approval process. Activists say the mine will negatively affect the environment and impact the cultural heritage of the area. FSRN's Donna Lepidot reports from the capital, Bucharest.
Since Sunday, between 1 and 2,000 protesters have been gathering each night in the capital for an unauthorized protest. Freedom, they say. We die, we fight, we save Roșia-Montana. On Sunday and Monday nights, demonstrators blocked roads downtown. Police did not interfere with the non-violent actions. Last night, protesters established themselves in a public area in the city center, chanting slogans like "Abolish that law" and "Gold for them, cyanide for us." The Canadian company Gabriel Resources owns a controlling share in the Roșia-Montana mine, which is reportedly worth about $15 billion. The company says its new state-of-the-art of mining facility will bring jobs and boost the economy, but acknowledges that many families will have to be relocated for the project to move forward. The law being considered by Parliament would transfer an additional 5% of the mine ownership from Gabriel Resources to the Romanian state. Lawmakers are expected to act on the legislation soon, but a tentative proposal for a nationwide referendum on the issue is also in the mix. Protest actions are expected to continue through the week, with a larger gathering scheduled for Sunday night. Dana Lepodat, FSRN, Bucharest.
In the UK, global environmental watchdog Greenpeace today set up a noisy fake fracking rig in front of the Lancashire Council office. The councillors are considering whether to allow energy company Quadrilla to continue drilling operations in the county. Today's action follows similar protests throughout Britain over the past month. FSRN's Francis Ngwa reports from Liverpool.
Workers in the Lancashire County Council in Preston today were confronted by 10 Greenpeace protesters who had constructed a mock drilling rig in front of their office. They erected an 8-foot fence around the display to prevent police from dismantling it. The activists have been loudly playing a soundtrack of drills, trucks, and industrial plants in an attempt to demonstrate to lawmakers the noise that is generated when someone leaves near a drilling operation. The Greenpeace activists are lobbying the councillors to deny an application from Quadrilla Resources to dig more wells as they try to extend their operations across the UK. The company's previous drilling efforts were halted after a string of minor earthquakes in the area. Quadrilla is the same company at the centre of weeks-long protests in the southern English town of Balcombe Bay. Its current drilling permit expires at the end of September. Quadrilla withdrew a request to extend its drilling operations, but on Tuesday, officials said they intend to apply to carry out further viability testing. Francis Ngwa, FSRN, Liverpool.
A recent spate of sectarian attacks continued today in Iraq. 16 members of a Shia family were shot by unidentified gunmen south of Baghdad. The men then blew up their homes, according to Al Jazeera. An estimated 4,000 people have been killed in such attacks since the beginning of the year, with about 800 dead in August alone. A massive electricity interruption in Venezuela left about 70% of the country without power for much of the afternoon yesterday. The government blamed unspecified saboteurs for the blackout, saying the main transmission line was corrupted. Most power was reportedly restored by evening. And finally, the Texas and Mississippi National Guards say they won't universally provide benefits for same-sex partners in their service. This contradicts a direct order from the Pentagon to recognize married gay and lesbian couples. The military began processing those applications yesterday. Major General John Nichols, who commands the Texas Guard, cited a conflict between state and federal law and said he was seeking a legal resolution to the case. In a memo, Nichols said same-sex couples would need to apply at other federal offices in the state. In Mississippi, the AP reports National Guard leadership will only accept applications for benefits at its offices that are on federally owned land. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington today, a key Senate committee passed a revised authorization for the U.S. to attack Syria, a version narrower than the open-ended draft submitted by President Obama. 10 lawmakers voted yes, 7 voted no, and 1 voted present, as the committee's counterparts in the House of Representatives questioned officials from the military and State Department. Both lawmakers and legal experts are raising concerns about the Obama administration's repeated assertion that it does not need approval either from Congress or the United Nations to conduct a military strike. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee resolution would give President Obama permission to conduct military strikes in Syria, but prohibit combat troops on the ground. While the president's draft included no time limit, the Senate's only authorizes 60 days of strikes, with the possibility of another 30 days if the president justifies the extension to Congress. For any military action to be authorized, it requires a determination that the U.S. has, quote, used all appropriate diplomatic and other peaceful means to prevent the deployment and use of weapons of mass destruction by Syria. The president must also justify that a military strike is necessary and in the, quote, core national security interest of the U.S. Both the president and secretary of state have been using this same language of national security interest this week in drumming up support for a strike on Syria. Attorney Bahar Azmi with the Center for Constitutional Rights called it a dangerous premise.
The problem with a construction about national security interest is it's in the eye of the beholder. In this case, the beholder is the administration armed with information that they're not particularly willing to share with the American public, and it's an entirely open-ended conception that's not tied to law. It appears to have no beginning and no end.
In addition to his concerns about the Senate resolution, both Azmi and other experts say any congressional authorization for military force would not meet global legal standards. Author and Middle East scholar Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies said the U.S. would either need to be in imminent danger or have approval from the United Nations Security Council in order to attack Syria, neither of which are currently true.
Whether the Congress says yes or not, this would still be an illegal act under international law. International law doesn't say that it's okay for one country to assault another country whenever it chooses, if its parliament agrees, if its Congress agrees.
Bennis criticized the Obama administration for holding up Russia and China's reluctance to support a strike on Syria as a reason for abandoning efforts to work through the UN Security Council.
It was designed in the UN Charter to be difficult to get approval to go to war. That was the whole point, to avoid wars. So it's supposed to be hard. It's supposed to happen almost never. And the idea that if we don't like the result, we'll simply ignore it, really makes the U.S. once again acting like a rogue state.
As both chambers of Congress continue to debate this week on taking military action against Syria, the president, Secretary of State John Kerry, and some party leaders say approval from Congress is not needed for the military to act. One claim given Wednesday by Kerry and Pentagon Chief Chuck Hagel at a House hearing on Syria is that the proposed strikes did not technically count as war.
We are not asking America to go to war. And I say that sitting next to two individuals who well know what war is, and there are others here today who know what war is. They know the difference between going to war and what the president is requesting now. We all agree there will be no American boots on the ground. The president is asking only for the power to make certain that the United States of America means what we say. He is asking for authorization, targeted and limited, to deter and degrade Bashar al-Assad's capacity to use chemical weapons.
But many legal and human rights organizations say an airstrike in Syria, just like one in the U.S. or anywhere else, would be considered an act of war. Congress aims to vote on the military force authorization next week. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
As the debate in Congress over military action in Syria continues, some legal experts are instead pushing for other non-military options. They're calling on the U.S. to do more to confront its own legacy of possessing weapons of mass destruction and to take a leadership role in ending their use throughout the world. Jackie Cabasso is executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation. The group focuses on weapons of mass destruction. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for having me.
So at this point, there are allegations of chemical weapons use in Syria. There's an unfinished UN investigation into this and other attacks. What does international law, whether it's the UN Charter or other legal frameworks, what does it say about the use of military force in this situation?
Well, first of all, let me say that the United Nations Charter is the highest treaty in the world. It supersedes states' conflicting obligations under any other international agreements. And under the United Nations Charter, which is binding on the United States under domestic law, it would be patently illegal for the United States to unilaterally attack another state without authorization from the Security Council or without meeting certain criteria for self-defense. The apparent chemical weapons use in Syria is abhorrent. It is also illegal under the Chemical Weapons Convention, even though Syria is not a signatory to that convention. 189 states, including the United States, are. And the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the guardian of international law, clearly considers the Chemical Weapons Convention to be customary international law. So we have here a situation where an illegal act has been committed by party or parties as yet unknown, and there is no agreement within the Security Council, which is responsible for protecting international peace and security, to take military action.
Well, as you know, there is no resolution, no agreed-upon action in the UN Security Council. Can you talk more about the Chemical Weapons Convention? As you said, Syria is not a member to the convention. The U.S. is, along with more than 180 other countries. What is the guidance for this kind of situation?
Well, there are provisions in the Chemical Weapons Convention for convening of an emergency meeting, either of its executive council or its membership. And we certainly think that the Chemical Weapons Convention parties should convene an emergency meeting. They have the authority to refer a request to the United Nations Security Council and to cooperate with the United Nations Security Council and the General Assembly. In fact, it is under the provisions of the agreement between the Chemical Weapons Convention and the United Nations that some of the inspectors from the Chemical Weapons Convention organization are participating in the Syrian inquiry. So we think that an emergency meeting could be convened, should be convened, that the mandate of the UN weapons inspectors should be extended and expanded to also allow them to try to determine responsibility. In the meantime, the Security Council could certainly issue a condemnation of the use of these illegal, immoral weapons.
Jackie Cabasso with the Western States Legal Foundation. You've outlined some of the non-military options that are available at this point. Now, speaking more broadly, the U.S. possesses and has used internationally condemned weapons. Those include white phosphorus, napalm, cluster bombs, also has a stockpile of chemical and nuclear weapons. Are there other steps the administration could take to address this global problem of massive deadly weapons?
Absolutely. And in fact, there are three new international forums dealing with nuclear disarmament that the United States has been ignoring or not participating in or boycotting or participating at a very low level. The first is the first ever high-level meeting on nuclear disarmament that will be held at the United Nations on September 26th. The U.S. has not commented on it officially, but we understand unofficially that the U.S. will be sending a representative from the State Department, an Undersecretary of State, not the President, not the Secretary of State. The U.S. boycotted the first ever meeting of countries on the dealing with the humanitarian impacts of nuclear weapons, which was hosted by the government of Norway and Oslo in February with 127 countries in attendance. A follow-up meeting is being hosted in Mexico in February. The United States could and should participate constructively in that. Finally, in connection with the 2010 review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the United States agreed with all of the other parties on the convening of a conference on establishing a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East, including all states and including nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The U.S. subsequently obstructed the convening of that conference, which now seems even more highly relevant than at the time. So the U.S. could easily become a constructive player in these international nuclear disarmament forums to demonstrate its seriousness about addressing nuclear weapons, which are the most destructive weapons of mass destruction of all.
Jackie Cabasso is Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation. She joined us to discuss international law and Syria. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
In South Sudan, parts of the country are dealing with the worst floods in decades. Nearly 20,000 people are displaced from their homes, and humanitarian groups have begun emergency medical responses. Aid officials also say they expect more flooding as the rainy season continues, which poses an increased risk of disease and threats to local agriculture. UN Radio's Jerry Adams reports.
United Nations relief workers get a bird's-eye view of Maiwit County that's inundated with water in Upper Nile State. They have come to see hundreds of people who have been displaced by floods and have gathered at a dry part of the county. Women and children are among the displaced people sitting under the shade of trees. One of the displaced women is Nyanbit Tut.
We came here because of water. Water destroyed our home. This is why we came here to this dry place. We lost our properties. Everything we have was destroyed by water. We need food and shelter.
Unfortunately for the displaced people of Maiwit, their ordeal is not going to be over soon, as Gadith Bol, commissioner of the county, explains.
The situation has not changed. In fact, it is keeping deteriorating almost on a daily basis. You can see this is what we have gone through for the last 11 days, and we are expecting more as this is the beginning of the rainy season in Maiwit County. So the rain started earlier this time, and we expect it to continue. Then we don't know when it's going to stop.
Caroline Opuk, a return and reintegration officer of the UN mission in South Sudan, says this is a recurring problem.
We see people lose property, we see people's houses destroyed, we see them displaced. We see waterborne diseases, we see malaria. And year in, year out, we are doing the same things. We take them non-food items, we take them medicine.
Humanitarian agencies have made some observations about the effects of the floods in East Central Africa, where South Sudan is located, Ms. Opok adds.
The effects of these floods can be minimized. And especially knowing that these are low-lying areas, knowing that every rainy season this will happen, knowing that the effects will still be the same. So yes, there will be some responses. There will be responses especially with issues of treatment for malaria, prevention of waterborne diseases. There will be some bit of a response in issues of households that have lost a bit of their food.
According to the United Nations Humanitarian Agency, this year's floods in that part of Africa are the worst in two decades. The agency says that people in South Sudan fear more rains from across the neighboring Ethiopian highlands. Jerry Adams, United Nations.
Among the majority Pashtun tribes in Afghanistan and Pakistan, a conference of elders called a jirga is a centuries-old tradition. It's used to resolve disputes and hear criminal cases. Jirga members and their decisions are respected by the community. But until recently, the tradition has been entirely run by men, with women cut out of the process. Now, a female jirga has been formed in the Pashtun-majority area of Swat in Pakistan. The first of its kind, the Kawindo Tolana, or Sisters Group, holds meetings and makes decisions like any other jirga in the country. From Swat, Pakistan, FSRN's Malik Ayub Sumbal has more.
This is Sadhu Sharif, the capital of Swat Valley in the volatile Pakistani province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. The province, once a popular tourist destination, has had its share of violence, including coming under control of militants who were then attacked during a massive military campaign by the country's security forces. Magora city in Swat Valley is also the hometown of teenage education activist Malala Yousafzai, who was shot in the head by Taliban in a targeted assassination attempt. But women in the region have not been deterred.
My name is Tabassum, and I work with Shirkatka, an NGO. I also formed the first woman jirga in Swat.
Tabassum Bashir is a humanitarian activist with the local women's rights NGO Shirkatka. She saw a great need for a body of women who could make decisions on issues that directly affected them. The decisions made in the all-male jirgas usually includes one like Swara, in which female members of the family are married to someone in a rival tribe to end a family feud. Usually, decisions like these are made against the will of these women.
Actually, we need to formulate the jirga for women because we do not get representation in the male jirga. And the decisions taken there are mostly against the women. If you see, decisions like Sawabra destroy girls only.
Tabassum Bashir is amongst the few fortunate women in the valley to have gotten an education and full support from her husband and family. She plans to fight for women's rights with the jirga, but that's not all. She wants to modernize the concept of traditional jirga.
It is not an experiment. It is a solid presence. See, the small domestic issues are mostly solved within the jirga. But it is not a traditional jirga. We want to let the male jirga people know that we do not impose decisions on our own. We do not want to decide on murder cases in this jirga. We have the judiciary, law, courts, and police. We include them all where we know we cannot handle the case.
Tabassum says they are communicating with legal advisors and police in the case of two murders and the attempted rape of an 8-year-old. Though still considered volatile in parts, Swat Valley is slowly becoming more modernized and the new jirga is playing an important role. There are 25 members of the women jirga. Most of them are educated women and former representative of the Swat local government. They address cases ranging from domestic violence to rape and murder. Even if the cases fall out of their jurisdiction, the jirga member provide the complainant with legal advice and a follow-up to the case. Tahira Bashir is a member of the jirga. She believes the model could help advance women's rights.
The women in Swat are depressed and they have a lot of problems. They need a platform for the solution of their problems and a way to solve these problems themselves. They must be aware of their rights, and we are doing this job and giving them awareness.
Another important aspect of the women's jirga is that it is open to men to have their cases heard and resolved. In such a case, a local man contacted the jirga to find justice for his 9-year-old daughter who was raped. But most of the issues heard come from women, including those from small villages and towns in the valley. Bano Bibi came because her daughter was the victim of an acid attack by her husband, who later murdered her.
We are poor people and have no place for seeking justice. So I came here, and this jirga registered the case of my daughter's murder. They provided us with a lawyer and other legal assistance, free of cost. So this female jirga is not less than a blessing in this area.
Most of the male jirgas in Swat are opposed to the female jirga. But one has not only accepted the woman's jirga, but has offered its support. Some locals say that's because it works on the humanitarian cases only and does not address religious issues. Nayaz Ahmad, a local journalist, says the woman's jirga is appropriate for some issues.
I have observed the work of the women's jirga in Saidu Sharif, and I believe it's a good thing that women have formulated a jirga to sort out their issues at a basic level. I have talked to their head, Tabassum Bashir, and she told me about the issues that women do not want to discuss with men, so it's a good thing that domestic issues and small disputes could be sorted out locally before going to the police or court.
But women's rights advocate Tabassum Bashir does not consider local and domestic disputes the prime responsibility of her jirga. She believes in across the board justice for women and girls being targeted in the society. Domestic violence is one of her priorities, but she wants the government to step in to end violence against women. The increasing number of female killings bothers her more than the domestic violence, and she wants the blood spree to end immediately.
I would like to discuss a very important issue here, that we talk about female education and women's rights everywhere. We talk a lot about them. First, the domestic violence bill implemented in this province has not been properly administered here. Second, our girls will only grow up, study, and become a mother or a sister if they stay alive. In other cases, they won't become anything at all.
Despite criticism and bashing by the traditional jirgas in the city, the 25 members of Pakistan's first women's jirga say that they will stay strong, fighting to empower local women and strengthen human rights in the tribal areas. Malik Ayub Sumbul, Free Speech Radio News, Saidu Sharif, Swat Valley.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.